This is Audible.
Ravenna Returned by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. Words, not deeds. Dedication over the main entrance of the Administrative Tower, Formal A, Petropolis. In the prosecution of his work, an agent of the Holy Inquisition may display a badge of office, which shall be a rosette bearing a crimson sigil. This may be further inscribed with the mark of his affiliated ordo, or the code of his issuing officio planetia. It is his symbol of authority, stark and unequivocal. Under certain circumstances, an agent of the Holy Inquisition may elect instead to carry the mark of special condition, which shall be a rosette bearing an azure sigil. This denotes the bearer to be operating alone, beyond the resource or support of any ordo, rogue, driven to independence by extremis, who will act with singular devotion and recognize no law or master save the God Emperor himself. From the Inquisition's Rubric of Protocol. Then. Just after firetide, Bonner's Reach, Lucky Space, 402.M41.
You.
The voice was so low, so very, very deep, the single word resounded like a seismic rumble. A curious hush fell across the vast free trade salon. People began to look. Some picked up their drinks and moved away. They knew what this was. The implanted eyes of all the vigilants present also turned to stare at the confrontation, green and cold. But they would not intervene, not unless the code of the Reach was broken.
You,
the voice repeated. To his credit, the man in the lizard-skin coat had not turned around. He was sitting at one of the high tables, conducting some business with a pair of far traders. The traders both looked up nervously at the figure standing behind the man in the lizard-skin coat.
I think you're being addressed,
one of them muttered.
I have no business with anyone here except you two gentlemen, the man in the lizard-skin coat said loudly.
He picked up one of the napkins on which the traders had just been scribbling cost estimates.
Now this figure here seems very high.
The far traders pushed back their chairs and stood up.
Our business is done, one of them said stiffly. We don't want to get involved in whatever this is.
The man in the lizard-skin coat tutted and got to his feet.
Sit down, he told the traders. Order another flask of Amasek from the tenders on my account. I'll just deal with this and we can resume.
He turned around. Slowly, he lifted his gaze until he was looking up at the face of the man who had interrupted his meeting. Lucius Vorna had been in the bounty game for 15 decades. And every second of those savage years showed in his face. His head, shaved apart from a bleached stripe, was one big scar. Livid canyons split through his lips and eyebrows and formed white ridges on his cheeks and jawline. His ears and nose were just eroded stubs of gristle. The blemish of old wounds overlaid one another, scar tissue upon scar tissue. The carapace armor he wore had been polished until it shone like mother of pearl. Even without its plated bulk, he would have been a big man.
I have a warrant,
Lucius Vorna declared.
You must be very pleased, the man in the lizard-skin coat said.
For you.
I don't think so,
the man in the lizard-skin coat said, and began to turn away again. Lucius Vorna raised his left paw and displayed the warrant slate. The hololithic image of a man's head appeared in front of it and gently revolved.
Armand Vessian, 278 counts, including fraud, malpractice, embezzlement, illegal trading, mutilation, and mass murder.
The man in the lizard-skin coat pointed one lean, well-manicured finger at the slate's image.
If you think that looks remotely like me, you're not very good at your job.
Behind him, the far traders chuckled.
Get on your way, bounty, one of them said as his confidence returned. Any fool can see that's not our friend here. Lucius Vorner kept staring at the man in the lizard-skin coat.
This face is Vessian's birth face. He has changed it many times, in order to evade the authorities. He escaped death row incarceration on Hesperus, and absconded from that planet by smuggling himself off-world a piece at a time.
I think you've had too much to drink, one of the traders laughed.
I don't really care what you think,
replied Vorner.
I know what I know. Armand Vessian had himself physically disassembled by a black market surgeon on Hesperus. His component parts, hands, eyes, limbs, organs, were grafted onto couriers, hired mules who conveyed them off-planet. Vessian himself, wearing a body made up of all the transplants removed from said mules, followed them. He later slaughtered the mules instead of paying them what he'd promised, and harvested his component parts back, reassembling himself. All, except the face. There's one mule still to find, isn't there, Vessian? That's why you're trying to arrange passage to Sarum.
Vorner glanced sideways at the far traders.
That's what he's after, isn't it? Passage to Sarum.
The traders looked at each other. One nodded slowly.
This really is nonsense, the man in the lizard-skin coat smirked. My name is Drin Degamini, and I'm a legitimate businessman. Your suggestion is little short of farce. I cut myself apart, did I? Posted myself off-world, bit by bit, attached to others, and now I'm sewn back together.
He laughed. Some onlookers sniggered, too.
Not sewn. Surgically rebonded. A process paid for by the 400,000 crowns you embezzled from the Imperial Guard Veterans Association on Hesperus while you were acting as their treasurer. They sponsored this bounty, as did the families of the mules you used and killed.
You're just annoying me now, said the man in the lizard-skin coat. Go away.
Lucius Vorner adjusted the setting of the warrant slate. The headshot changed.
Just the face left, and this is the face of the mule you used to smuggle your features out.
The far traders suddenly began to back away. The hololithic image now plainly showed a perfect match for the face of the man in a lizard-skin coat. The man sighed sadly, as if all the air had drained out of him, and bowed his head.
Armand Vessian, Vorner intoned, I have a warrant for your...
The man in the lizard-skin coat flicked out his right arm and stabbed the bounty hunter in the face. Lucius Vorner recoiled slightly and dropped the warrant slate. The flesh of his right cheek was sliced open to the bone. There was blood everywhere. A shocked murmur ran through the onlookers. No one quite understood what had just happened. They'd barely seen the man in the lizard-skin coat move, let alone produce a weapon. With a resigned shrug, ignoring the terrible wound, Lucius Vorner lunged at his quarry. Vessian darted aside, easily avoiding his big, clumsy opponent. He moved like quicksilver, and as he ducked under Vorner's reaching arms, he lashed out with a sideways kick. This should have been as successful as kicking a bane blade. Vessian was slender and unarmored. It seemed insanity for him to try and take on a giant in a suit of powered battle plate in close combat. But the kick connected, and Lucius Vorner was flung sideways, thrown by a force even his suit's inertial dampers couldn't deal with. He crashed into the high table, knocking over the drinks and two of the chairs. Then the man in the lizard-skin coat was on his back, right hand raised to strike at the nape of Vorner's neck. Just for an instant, the onlookers glimpsed that hand and understood. It was folded open, like the petals of a flower, hinged apart between the middle and ring fingers. A double-edged blade poked from the aperture. A graft weapon, an implant. The hideously folded fingers seemed to form a hilt for the blade. Vorner reached around, grabbed the shoulder of the lizard-skin coat, and flung the man over his head. The man somersaulted in mid-air, controlled his fall, and bounced feet first off the far end of the high table, with enough force to slam the table's opposite edge up into Vorner's chin. Vorner staggered back. Vessian landed on the salon floor and renewed his attack. The onlookers in the free trade salon crowded in closer, astonished by what they were witnessing. Some of them had seen the bounty hunter at work before. You didn't mess with that, not hand to hand, unless you were crazy, or suicidal, or something else entirely. Something laced with grafts and glands and implants. Something so augmentically re-engineered it would take on a monster without hesitation. In any fight, there was an underdog. Despite all physical appearances to the contrary, that underdog was Lucius Vorner. This was something the crowd wanted a ringside seat to see. Vorner threw two heavy punches at the man in the lizard-skin coat. Each one would have demolished his skull if it had connected. But Armand Vessian seemed to slide out around them, leaving empty air. He landed two strikes of his own. His graft blade slid through Vorner's left eyebrow, and his left fist actually dented the mother-of-pearl surface of Vorner's chest plate. Vorner stumbled away from the force of the blows. Vessian's left hand produced a scissor from the pocket of the lizard-skin coat. The warmth of his hand woke the large black beetle thing up, and its exposed mandibles, razor-sharp, began to chitter and thrash.
"You've picked on the wrong man tonight," he hissed as he came in again.
Vorner swung around. Again, his punch hit nothing but space. Vessian had danced nimbly to the left and stabbed the graft blade up under Vorner's left shoulder guard. He tugged the blade out, escaping the blind retaliation. Now, blood was spurting down the bounty hunter's left bicep guard. Vorner pivoted at the hips and clawed at his adversary. Vessian backed away with abnormal speed, executed a deft tumble, and came back on his feet behind his cumbersome opponent. The scissor ripped into Vorner's lumbar plating, the mandibles chewing through it like it was tissue paper. Vorner pulled away, but no matter how tightly he turned, he was just a thundering hulk in heavy armor, and Vessian was always behind him, jittery fast. Vessian was glanding something potent, and hyperactivity pulsed through his hard-wired, reconstructed body. Vorner made another desperate grab. Vessian kicked him in the face, and then followed the kick with another stab of the graft blade. The blade punched through the bounty hunter's midriff armor, where it stuck fast. Vessian swallowed. Vorner grabbed the man in the lizard-skin coat by the right wrist and wrenched the graft blade out of his belly. As the scissor chattered in, Vorner caught that wrist too. Vessian's eyes went glassy wide. Glanding, he was faster than the massive bounty hunter, and almost as strong. Almost. Struggling, Vorner raised the man's right wrist until the graft blade was in front of his face. They were locked, quivering with matched fury. Vorner slowly leaned his head forward and bit the graft blade in half. Vessian squealed. Lucius Vorner laughed, a deep, booming laugh, and spat the broken blade out of his mouth. He let go of Vessian's right hand and yanked on the other wrist, straightening Vessian's left arm as he brought his free fist up under it. The left elbow of the man in the lizard-skin coat snapped the wrong way, with a bone crack that made the onlookers wince. The scissor fell onto the floor and began to eat the carpet. Vessian started to squeal again, but the squeal ended abruptly as Vorner's right hand punched him in the face and sent him flying across the floor.
"End of story," said Lucius Vorner.
Oblivious to the blood streaming from his wounds, Vorner clanked towards the fallen man. Vessian lay in a twisted heap, his broken arm limp and dislocated like a snapped twig. He was moaning, blood pattering from his mashed lips.
"I have a warrant,"
Vorner boomed, his voice like tectonic plates scraping together. Closing his bitten-off graft weapon so that his hand refolded, Vessian fumbled into his lizard-skin coat and wrapped his fingers around the summoning whistle. His last resort. It had cost him a fortune, more than all his body enhancements, in fact, and he'd not used it before. But he knew what it did. And if there ever was a moment for it, this was it. It wasn't actually a whistle. It was a smooth piece of rock that had been hollowed out by a technology unknown to the Imperium. But blowing through it was the only way a human could activate it. Vessian blew. All the onlookers winced, glasses shattered on the salon tables. The huge biolumen tank lights, suspended in clusters from the salon's high roof, flickered. Every Forpasi in the chamber fell down, ears bleeding. 10 meters from Armand Vessian, the nature of space-time buckled and popped apart. The surface of the air itself bubbled and began dripping, like the emulsion of an old tin-type pict exposed to flame. A seething iridescent vortex whisked up from molten, pustular matter.
yawned into being, and the hound stepped out of it. Just a skeleton at first, dry clicking into view. Then, as it came on, organs materialized inside its ribcage. Blood systems wrote themselves into being. Muscle grew, sinews, flesh. It solidified, clothing its reeking yellow bones in meat. It was hinid in structure, its forelimbs long, its back sloping off to short hind legs. Its skull was massive, with a pincer jaw and long yellow fangs that could shred anything, even a man in ceramite armor. It stood 2 meters tall at the hunched shoulders. Its eyes were white, the hair on its hunchback a bristly black. The eager onlookers now recoiled. The traders and merchants in the salon began to flee in blind panic, along with the tenders. Not just from the sight of the monster, but also from the smell of it. The gross stink of the warp. Vorna turned to face it, drawing an execution sword from his harness. He knew it would be over fast, just as well as he knew the outcome wouldn't favor him. Vessian began to laugh, despite his injuries.
"You picked on the wrong man, you frigger! The wrong man!"
The vortex faded. Now fully manifest, the hound padded forward, about to spring, intent on the prey it had been summoned to destroy. The vigilants swarmed onto it from all sides, lashing into it with their hand-and-a-half swords. Blades rained and sliced. The hound coiled and turned. But by then it was already too late. In less than 20 seconds, the vigilants had hacked it into bloody slabs and shreds. The vigilants turned, as one, to face Vorna. In unison they rested their blood-stained swords on the floor, tipped down, their hands folded over the pommels.
"No throne, no,"
gurgled the man in the lizard-skin coat.
"Code," Vorna said. "The code of the Reach. No weapon is permitted that has a range longer than a human arm. And that came from more than an arm's reach away."
Vorna picked up the sizor. It wriggled in his hand, chittering.
"The mule wants his face back," he said.
And that was when the man in the lizard-skin coat really learned to scream.
"Holy throne," remarked Ornales. "I honestly don't think we need a piece of that."
The free trade salon stank of blood, and other things less savory. Under the watchful gaze of the vigilants, tenders were hosing the floor down. A few traders had been lured back in with the promise of free drinks. Business was still business at Bonner's Reach.
"No, I think we do," Siskin told his first officer. "His type comes with trouble."
"Only for the ones he's going after," said Siskin. "Come on."
"What do you want?"
asked Lucius Vorna, barely looking up as they approached. He was just finishing packing the various tagged and numbered pieces of Armand Vessian into the individual cryo-caskets his servitors held ready.
"I want to retain your services," Siskin said.
Vorna straightened up and looked at the ship captain directly.
"You sure? Some people don't like what they get. If this is a midnight wish, then forget it. You're drunk. Go to your bed."
"A midnight wish?"
Siskin echoed.
"Look at your cron, master,"
Vorna rumbled, returning to his labors.
"The Imperial calendar is about to flick over one more meaningless digit. A new year. If you're partied up and fancy to settle some old score, sleep on it. I'll still be here in the morning."
"No," said Siskind. "I know what I'm doing. I want the services of a bounty tracker. I'm prepared to pay."
"How much?"
asked Vorna. Siskind glanced at Ornales.
20 thou, plus a 10% stake of whatever cut we make."
Lucius Vorna dropped a still twitching hand into one of the icy caskets and closed the lid. He looked at Siskind.
"You've got my attention," he growled. "What sort of cut are we looking at?"
"Do you know you're still kind of bleeding there?"
Ornales said timidly, indicating his cheek.
"Yeah,"
Vorna replied.
"You're going to sew me back up, pussy boy?"
No, I just...
"Then I'll get to it when I get to it,"
Vorna said.
"What sort of cut?"
6, maybe 7 million in the first year.
"At 10%? That's a real lot. What's the job?"
"I need you to hunt for me."
"That's what I do."
"I was meant to meet a body here at Bonner's Reach. A good friend. Name of Thekla."
"So?" Go look around.
I have, Siskind replied. He's not here. He told me he would be, at Firetide, but he's not. If he'd gone out on some trade run, he would have left a message here for me on the personal spindles. But he hasn't.
Why is it so important?
I know he has enemies.
Yeah.
Siskind shrugged. I want to employ you, Vorna, to find my friend. Or find the bastard who killed him before he got here. There's a lot riding on it.
And who might this bastard be?
Vorna asked. Gideon Ravener, an Imperial Inquisitor. Is that a problem?
Not even slightly,
said Lucius Vorna.
Now, local winter time, Eustis Majoris, 403.M41. I have to admit, after 10 months aboard the Arethusa, I am filled with an almost unquenchable desire to throttle Shipmaster Sholto Unworth, and I don't have any hands. I employed Unworth through my team principals. It was, in fact, Harlan Nail who arranged the contract and negotiated the terms of Unworth's service. The price had seemed agreeable at the time, but as it turns out, there were hidden costs, infuriation being chief amongst them. Unworth is diligent enough, and ineffably eager to please me. It is clear he takes his secret compact to serve the orders of the Imperial Inquisition very seriously. But he is everywhere. Everywhere I turn, underfoot, tormenting me with questions, and butchering the language with such a disregard for... Well, enough. It has been a trying time. The trap at Bonner's Reach tested us all, and cost us. I doubt Sinia Priest will ever forgive me for the damage done to her beloved ship, and the losses suffered by her crew. I glide along the third deck companionway of the Arethusa, towards the small stateroom Unworth obliged me with. Zael is there, playing some game of his own devising with the pieces of my regicide set. He's just a boy, sallow, shaggy-haired, no more than 14. He often tells me he's 18, and I know he's lying. I also know he doesn't know what the truth is. Zael looks up as I whisper in. After all this time, he's still not used to my presence and appearance. I sense his fear. I am no longer made as other men are. Grievous injuries, received over 60 years ago on Thracian Primaris, have left me confined to an armored, enclosing support chair. The chair is dark matte, sleek, suspended, and propelled by a humming field projected by the ever-turning anti-grav hoop. I am just a mind, wrapped in a shred of ruined flesh, locked in a mobile life support unit. I have no face anymore.
Ravener, Zael says. For all his wariness, he has never been afraid to call me by my name. No rank, no deference. Behind my back, I know he calls me the chair. Want to play? He asks.
I've been attempting to teach him the rudiments of regicide. So has Nail. It is diverting to sit with Zael and push the playing pieces around the board with my mind. But for a bright lad, he's slow to pick up the knack. I switch to speech via my chair's mechanical voxponder. My words issue flat and monotonous, a quality I despise, but Zael is unsettled by my sigh voice. I have work to do, Zael. Can you find somewhere else to be? Zael nods. He gets up. From the flash of his surface thoughts, I understand he's deciding whether to seek out Nail and ask him impertinent questions about women, or go and torment Unworth's manhound, Fiflank.
Zael's excited. I pick that up, too.
We're going home, to what he thinks of as home anyway. It's just a few days away now. We are going back to the place where all this started, before I went off chasing wild geese. To finish it. Zael leaves. I shut the hatch with a flick of telekinesis and slide the bolt. Alone, I turn the chair to face the transcriber unit. Another flick, and it turns on, ready. I start to write, moving the stylus armature with my mind. To my lord, Rorkin, Grand Master of the Orders Helicon, salutations. Sir, this missive is a testament... Too slow and fussy. Too painstaking. I am seized by an urgency to get it all down at last, almost as if time is running out. I extend a mechadendrite cable from the base of my chair and link it to the transcriber's terminal. Now, all I have to do
is think the words.
Sir, this missive is a testament, and I am recording it in the event that I will not survive to communicate it to you in person. I have sent this statement in encrypted form via Astropath to the Ordo office on Gudrun, with explicit instructions that it be delivered to you by a senior-ranking interrogator. It has opened and decrypted only because it has registered your biotemplate. You are the only one I can trust any more. The heresy I am endeavoring to expose may reach into the upper society of the Angela subsector itself. To the very top, I fear. My lord, here are the facts. Corroborating evidence may be found in the encrypted data curls attached to this report. In the early part of 401, I took my team to Eustis Majoris, capital world of the Angela subsector, to investigate the illicit trade in so-called flecks. These corrosively addictive objects are flooding the black market throughout the subsector group, smuggled in from the mergent worlds, rimwards, of Angelus. Flecks are dangerous things, abominably dangerous. They are splinters of glass from the billion broken windows of the decaying hive ruins out in the mergent worlds, swollen with abhuman energies due to their long exposure to the warp. They have soaked up the light of chaos, marinating for centuries in its glare. In these little splinters of corrupted glass, a user might glimpse a reflection of something wondrous and be uplifted for a brief time to some transcendent high. When they come down, they immediately crave another glimpse of the wonder, another look, as the slang goes. But a great number of flecks contain nothing except a fleeting vision of ultimate cosmic horror, a true vision of the warp. Such a sight destroys minds. And, of course, no user ever knows what he or she is about to see until they look into their next flecked. Flecks are a curse, a disease, a plague. They are more addictive and destructive than any of the prohibited chemical drugs that blight imperial culture. Not only do they kill, they corrupt. Every single flecked that passes into the community carries with it the potential to open a gateway to the ruinous powers and destroy the Imperium piecemeal from within. Reading this, it may surprise you, my lord, to hear that flecks are no longer my primary target. The trade must be stamped out, and the distribution of flecks stopped as soon as possible, and if I and my band can assist in that great work, so much the better. But because of the flecked trade, I have uncovered something far more insidious. The flecked trade is just the byproduct of a greater heresy. A cartel of rogue traders, operating under the terms of an off-book black-budget arrangement known as Contract 13, is providing the senior ministries of Eustis Majoris with tech salvage procured in secret from the polluted mergent worlds. This trade is in the form of codifiers, cogitators, and other calculating engines recovered from the warp-drowned imperial hives in that doomed territory. Someone very high up in the hierarchy of Eustis Majoris, is paying well for such tainted artifacts. At the time of writing, their motive is not clear to me. The cartel, risking everything to slip past the battlefleet blockade sanctioning the mergent worlds, and anxious to maximize their profits, has been smuggling in flecks as a supplement to their lucrative trade in logic engines. Ironic, then. I come to Eustis Majoris to choke the flecked trade, and the traces of it bring me to a greater threat. In their greed, the rogue traders have betrayed their true agenda. Contract 13. I pursued the matter of the flecks to the hilt, until it brought me face to face with agents of the Administratum itself, in the form of one Yeda Trice, first provost of the Ministry of Subsector Trade. He seemed to share my concern about flecks, and arranged for several of his agents to accompany my team on a trip to the black market source, up the line into what is known as Lucky Space. But this was a trap sprung by Trice's agents and by the rogue traders I was chasing. I commend them for their ingenuity. At Bonner's Reach, they took control of my ship, the Hinterlight, murdered several members of the crew, and sought to dispose of us into the local Star. Taking me down on Eustis would have caused a fuss. If I and my team failed to return from Lucky Space, it might have been years before anyone thought to examine why. My team and I prevailed, against the odds.
We overcame Trice's agents, and also the rogue trader, the October Country, which was their instrument for our deaths. I will convey a more complete report concerning these actions later, if I have the chance. In short, my lord, this is the situation. For want of any definite communique, our enemies on Eustis Majoris now assume that we are dead. My chartered ship, the Hinterlight, seriously damaged in the battle, is moving at low speed to the navy yards on Lenk, where I have made arrangements for it to be repaired. Along with my warband, I have procured transit aboard a freelance merchant ship called the Arethusa, which is giving us passage back to Eustis Majoris via Onkage, Fedra, Malinta, and Bostol. In other words, by an indirect route away from the Lenk-Flint trade lane. We intend to re-enter Eustis Majoris clandestinely. Our enemies believe us dead, and I do not intend to disabuse them of that idea. Undercover, anonymous, we will infiltrate the upper levels of the administry on the capital world and attempt to reveal the corruption there. Or die trying. That is why I am writing to you in this way. What we seek to uncover may run high. Yet Trice is second only to the Lord Governor Subsector, Oscar Ludolf Barazan himself. My lord, I may be about to topple the highest from power. The Angelus Sub might be plunged into confusion. I beg of you, stand ready. I don't know how far up this goes. For this reason, I am now operating under the terms of special condition status. As far as the galaxy is concerned, I am dead. My warriors are dead. We will play that deceit as far as it goes until it becomes the truth. At that time, may it be far off, the Emperor protects, I trust you will action this missive and mobilize the orders to finish what I have started. In the name of Terra, your friend and servant, Gideon Ravener. The scratching stylus creeps to a halt. I instruct the transcriber to encode the document, keying it to a pheromonal sample of Rorkan kept in my chair's databanks. Then I retract the mechadendrite and turn away. There is one thing I have not covered in my report to the Grand Master. One detail. On our way back down through the edge worlds of the Angelus Sub, we diverted to the waste world Malinta because of a summons from an old friend. Call him Thorn. He warned me of a danger that had been predicted and foreseen. It might be me, it might be one of my team, but something was going to happen on Eustis that would make the Imperium shake. I wanted to believe it, but I couldn't see it. Thorn, God Emperor, watch him, was not as reliable as he used to be. I feared his judgment was off. I am sound. So are my people. I trust them all with my life. Maybe he had meant Unworth. There is a knocking at my cabin hatch. Yes?
Master Ravener, I would be obligated if you might spare a memento or two to circumcise this star chart. I am grandiose to be embroidering for your diverse perspicacity.
Unworth. Throne. Let it be Unworth that Thorn warned me about. Throttling him would be a pleasure. Part 1. Smoke and Mirrors. Chapter 1. Gyrus hammered, as moody as any, when the wet was on him, and the wet was on him now. Blurry-souled, knuck-brained, his left hand twitching like a beater-box, he woke from a dream where he had been awake all the time, dreaming of sleep. Gyrus was gut-hollow hungry and thirsty after the last flecked. His eyes were filmy, because they had been open and unblinking all the while he'd been asleep, staring at the pimple-bored tiles of his hab ceiling. Outside the broken window, the city boomed. Boomed as loud as the burning city that had backdropped his waking dream. Snatches of looped triumphal marches from the public tannoys, street vendor cries, pound music from the sink-level clubs, the drum of rain, bells, the whit-whump, whit-whump of a magistratum cruiser going past at full pursuit. The sounds of downstack Petropolis. Crap roaches ran up and down inside the panes of his eyes, and Gyrus moaned aloud, until he realized the roaches were real, and the surface they were running up and down was on the cracked plastic of his hab's casement. Gyrus found his gun under a sweat-wet pillow. A knock off Hostec 13 Longjaw, 20 in the clip, 2 in the spout. Reassuring as a mother's love. He aimed it at one of the roaches. Then he lowered his hand. Waste of a load. Man could get more for the price of a bullet than one bug. Especially when the wet was on him. Saint, but it was. He staggered to the wash sink and stared at himself in the mirror over the bowl. The mirror was dent smashed. He'd done that with his forehead the night before last, starving for a look to fleck him happy, angry with the mirror for being so nothing, so empty. Gyrus felt like butting it again, but his reflection showed a forehead still crusted with blood from the last time. He saw himself, a mound of vat-grafted muscle, a face peppered with clan piercings, a tongue, and he unrolled it now, fitted with its own snapping teeth at the tip. Beauty boy, slab clanner, moody hammer. In the cracked room behind his face, Nesha was still unconscious on the mattress. She lay twisted on top of the covers, her naked body dancing with snake tattoos. 2 cobrids were twisted over her belly and up around her bosom, the gaping mouths framing her dark nipples. She would be out for hours, but when she woke, she'd want a look too. More than want. Need. Need, screw you very much, sir. Need. Going out time. Hunting time. Scoring time. Gyrus flexed his arms and saw the gun still in his right paw. Just so. He grabbed his coat and his big black gamp. Street level. The city booming still. Burn alarms singing from the street posts as the rain pelted out of the west, showing up like a laser blitz in the sodium glow of the sidewalk lanterns. Vehicles splashing by. The bell. The bell again. The bell. Gyrus followed the sound. At the junction of Rudiment and Pass On Over, there was a chapel, a select place reserved for high-born worship. The bell was ringing from the acid-gnawed tower. Grand men in long-tail coats were hurrying along the pavement to attend the service. Gyrus joined them, gamping for one of the fine fellows. "My thanks," the man said, as they reached the chapel door, and palmed Gyrus a coin. Gyrus folded his gamp and let the rain trickle off it. Always a useful tool, the gamp. Everyone needs a gamper in Petropolis. Gyrus had got his from a 10-year-old boy he'd knifed to death in the underpass below Golgotten Walk. They were closing the chapel doors. Gyrus slipped inside, into the dry gloom, and made a hasty observance of the sacristy so he wouldn't look out of place. Down the aisle, the gentleman was settling in the front few pews as the cleric took the silk cloth off the triptych of St. Ferriolus, a patron of automation. Light sang down in colours through the apse windows. Unnoticed, Gyrus shuddered as an aftershock of his last look fluttered through him. He took a seat at the back. He smelled the acid in the rain dripping off his furled gamp as it bit into the marble floor. The gun felt deliciously heavy in the hip pocket of his coat. The service was beginning. The same old junk. The cleric intoning, and the unison answers echoing back in the congregation. Gyrus was back in the embracing shadows. Down the front, the gilded triptych was caught in a jetting beam of white light from the overheads, haloed, almost glorious. The cleric's hands moved in front of it, making symbols like pale puppets. Head down, Gyrus looked left. He saw the temple boys waiting behind the docile, straightening their cassocks and mantles, whispering to each other as they prepared the censer, the magnetum, and the plate. The plate. The offering plate. That was what Gyrus was interested in. A congregation like this, rich men from the inner formals. That plate could be a major score. Forget flex for tonight. This would be a week of looks, plus enough low and yellows to cushion the come-down afterwards. He was still twitchy. Calm. Calm, he told himself. He blinked. The cleric had just said something that sounded odd. The congregation answered. As Gyrus watched, the cleric touched the top of the triptych, and it folded in on itself. The tripart image it then revealed was worse than anything he'd ever seen. Even in his worst looks, he gasped and jumped in his seat. The images. The images, they were so... They reminded him of the dream of the burning city. Jairus realized he had wet himself involuntarily and cried out. Too much noise. The entire congregation, and the cleric himself, was looking back at him. Just make your exit. Just make your exit nice, and nothing needs to... Hello, said the man, sitting down beside him in the pew. Was all Jairus could manage.
I think you've come in for the wrong service, the man said gently.
I think so.
The man was lithe and long-limbed, his face lean and refined. His clothes were dark, immaculate. His hands were gloved.
What's your name?
The man asked.
My name is Tauros Revoke. Say nothing, Jairus thought.
My name is Jairus,
his mouth said anyway.
How do you do, Jairus? You're a clanner, am I right? What is it now? A moody hammer?
Yes, sir.
And you're... How's it go? Witchy for a look?
Yes, sir. I guess I am.
Why are you answering? Why are you answering him, you nuck?
Bad luck, old boy, the man said, and patted Jairus reassuringly on the thigh. Jairus cringed.
You weren't meant to see any of this. Closed chapel, you see. How did you get in?
There was something about the man, something in his eyes or tone that compelled Jairus to answer, even though he didn't want to.
I pretended I was a gamper, sir.
Did you? How cunning.
Master Revoke, the cleric called from the front. Is there a problem?
Just a poor man who mistook his way into our assembly, father. No need for a fuss. He'll be going shortly.
The man looked back at Jairus. His pupils were stale yellow, like burned-out suns.
What were you doing here?
He asked, softly.
I was just...
Jairus began.
Intending to rob the collection plate,
the man said, looking away.
To afford the price of a look. You were going to hold up this entire body of good people to slake your habit.
No, I, sir. I...
Somehow... The man had got hold of Jairus's gun. He held the weapon up.
With this.
Sir, I...
Jairus fought the man's compelling force. This was madness. He was a slab ox, vat-built. He ought to be able to crush a wimp like this in a heartbeat. He swung around, grabbed the man by his dove-gray lapels, and smashed him repeatedly against the pew back until the skull cracked open, red and wet. Then he ran for the chapel door and... Jairus was still sitting in the pew, unable to move. The man was smiling at him.
Interesting idea, the man said. Very robust, very direct, but never going to happen.
Please,
Jairus mumbled.
I'll tell you what, the man said,
reaching his free hand into his tailored coat, his other hand toying with the heavy handgun.
Here's one on me.
He handed Jairus a small parcel wrapped in red tissue paper.
Now, get on your way.
Two rectors unbolted the chapel doors for him. Jairus ran. He got as far as the ironworks above Belphegor Undersink before the steel teeth of panic finally began to relax their bite. His breathing was ragged, and he was twitching all over. He grabbed the handrail for support, leaning over, ignoring the acid itch on his palms from the recent rain. The man had been bad enough, but the other thing. The tripart image revealed when the triptych slid open. Most glorious throne of terror, what a thing! Of all things holy, that certainly wasn't one of them. The city sublevels lay below him, a blizzard of lights in the darkness under the ironwork. Jairus wanted to calm down, relax his pumping heart. He took out the parcel the man had given him, unwrapped the red tissue paper, and looked at the flecked. That would do it. Except that man, that soft-spoken man with his stale yellow eyes, how could he trust a man like that who simply gave flecks away? Jairus weighed the lump of glass in his hand, then turned and threw it into the darkness off the ironwork.
Shame.
Jairus turned. The man was sitting on the ironwork stairs behind him. He looked like he had been there for hours. He was smoking a low stick in a long holder, which he held pinched between his slim, gloved fingers. That would have been quick and clean. There would have been pain, but only very briefly. Jairus bunched his fists. We now have to move to other options.
What?
Jairus stammered. You saw too much. Far too much. And I'm a secretist. I'm paid to ensure there are no loose tongues. And your fine augmented tongue, Jairus, well, it looks loose to me.
I shall do this,
inquired a whisper-thin voice. Jairus realized that there was a second presence, standing on the stairs behind the man, so thin, so pale, almost transparent.
No need, Monica, the man said, getting to his feet. I feel like some practice.
The man flicked away his low stick, slid the holder into his pocket, and took a step towards Jairus. The half-visible figure behind him remained motionless. It really could have been quick, the man whispered. With the flecked, I mean. A happy way to go. It's not going to be quick now, and it certainly isn't going to be painless. Jairus settled his shoulders low and raised his hands.
Let's see,
he replied. It was the boldest thing he'd ever said, and it was the last thing he'd ever say. The man uttered something. A word that wasn't a word. A sound that wasn't a sound. A single syllable. Jairus reeled. He felt as if he'd been smacked in the face with a jackhammer. Blood sprayed from his mashed nose.
It's good,
whispered the half-visible figure. It gets better, said the man. He said three more unwords in quick succession, his lips flexing oddly to make and accommodate the sounds. Jairus shuddered as something broke his collarbone. Something else shattered his left elbow, and something else splintered his right knee. He fell down. The pain was enormous. Years before, he'd been beaten by a rival clan crew. They'd used panel hammers. He'd been in the public ward for 8 months. That had nothing on this. The man stood over Jairus, who clawed at his trouser leg. The man announced some more unwords. Jairus's teeth exploded out with the first, all of them, incisors like cracked porcelain, molars like bone pegs with their bloody roots. His tongue burst. The second unword detonated his spleen. The third caved in his ribs and collapsed his right lung. The fourth relapsed his colon. Blood was pouring out of him through every natural exit it could find. A final unword. Jairus's kidneys were quivered to mush.
He now is dead,
the half-visible figure asked. Ought to be, said the man. He paused and raised a glove to his face, dabbing a tiny trickle of blood that leaked from his own lower lip.
Your technique, it improves,
his companion noted.
Practice makes perfect, the man replied.
Jairus was still twitching. The blood draining out of him was streaming through the open mesh of the iron walk deck.
Can't leave him here, the man said. The wound type is very singular.
I will not carry him, not I. He smells, and he is messy.
The man looked up and called out, Drax. A third figure appeared, up at the roadway level. He was tall and slender, hunched about his heavy shoulders. A mane of wispy grey hair framed a face that was curiously shallow and wide, with small, piggy eyes and a massive jaw that gave him an underbite.
Mr. Revoke?
Pick him clean, please.
The newcomer, Drax, hurried down the stairs to join them. He was wearing a skin suit of leather jack armor with a row of buckles down his chest, but his entire right arm and hand were encased in a thick gauntlet of chainmail.
Step you back then, Mr. Revoke, he said.
He took a cyber lure from his belt, unwound the silver cord, and began to spin it in slow circles. The lure made a humming murmur.
Here they come, the little beauties.
Jairus coughed blood suddenly and opened his eyes. He stared up at the sky. The last thing he saw were the sheen birds, hundreds of them, mobbing down out of the dark towards him, metal pinions fluttering. They were the last thing he saw, because they went for his eyes first. The last thing he felt was agony. It lasted for 6 whole minutes as the sheen birds pecked and stripped the flesh from his bones. Chapter 2. So, late in the year 402.M41, we returned to Eustace Majoris to finish the work. It had been well over 12 months since we had last stood together on that dark, overpopulated planet, and we returned now incognito. Our enemies believed us to be long dead, so much the better. Secrecy was the only real weapon we had left. From the moment of our return onwards, everything would be secrets and lies, until death rendered all things equal and void. On the last night of our journey back, I visited my comrades one by one. It was a courtesy I paid out of respect. I was about to ask a lot from each one of them. I found Harlan Nail hunting game on a shelf of evergreen forest below a pearl-white glacier. The air was cold and thin. Will Tallowhand was with him, and they were walking together with their long rifles leaning across their shoulders. I approached through the long grass, spreading my hands to ruffle the stalks that swished around me. Will saw me first. He turned and smiled at me, then tapped Harlan on the shoulder. Will Tallowhand had been dead a long while. He called something out to me that I couldn't catch. By the time I'd reached them, he had faded away like smoke. Harlan Nail looked me up and down.
"Been a long time since you've done this, Gideon," he said.
"I know," I replied.
"Looking good," he said.
"Looking whole," I answered. He nodded. He was a big man, tall and corded with muscle. His bullet head was shaved but for a tuft of beard on his chin.
"Is it that bad?" he asked.
"That bad?" He shrugged.
"Been a long time, like I said. It must be bad for you to come to me like this. I think I know what you're here to ask."
"Do you now?" Harlan nodded again.
"Think I do. You want to know if I want to go on?"
"And do you?"
"I always thought I'd be in it for the long haul."
He looked away as his voice trailed off wistfully. The ghost shapes of pronghorn game were melting into the tree line. "Where is this?" I asked him. He shrugged.
"I forget. Dura, maybe. Or Gudrun. Sleep often brings me here. Although last time, the glacier was over there."
We reached the edge of a mountain lake, lying like a glass spearhead amongst the evergreens. It was so still and glassy, it mirrored the trees, the glacier, and the sky. And there we were, too, side by side. Harlan, broad-shouldered, thick-armed, his physique as tough and flexible and well-worn as the leather body glove he wore. And me, as I had been at the age of 34, an eternity before. A little shorter than Harlan, rather lighter in build, long black hair tied back from a high cheekboned face that I'd once seen regularly in other mirrors.
"What are you in your dreams?" Harlan asked.
"Am I like this, do you mean?"
"Yeah."
I shook my head. "No, not for years now. I dream like I live, confined and yet unlimited, in the darkness. But I thought I'd look like this for a change tonight."
"Because it's that bad. I hope this isn't a psychological game, you wearing your old face to remind us how we met you and who we first swore allegiance to. Hard to say no to someone's face."
"Do you want to say no?"
"Boss, we've been through plenty together. Plenty of bad things. Malach, that business on Dalsine. Stuff I don't want to remember. Is this really that much worse?"
I pause.
"It could be." "What about the others?"
"I haven't asked them yet. I'm asking you."
"And I'm saying yes. You're going to the others now?"
"Yes."
"Can I come?"
I said yes. We broke the mirror lake into shards and blurred into a stone cell in a tower on Sameter, where Patience Kiss was singing a lullaby to her long-lost sisters. Prudence and Providence were snuggled up in their cots, 10 years old. Outside, an electrical storm split the night.
"Who are those men?"
Prudence asked, pointing. Kiss turned sharply. The two silver kine blades pinning her long black hair plucked themselves free and circled towards us in the candlelight. I brushed them aside carefully. Even in dreams, such weapons can wound.
"What are you two doing here?"
Kiss spat. She was a tall, slender woman in her mid-20s, agile and quick. Unloosed, her straight black hair framed her pale, high cheekbones and her fierce green eyes. "I'm sorry to intrude, Patience," I began.
"He's come to ask the question, Kiss,"
Harlan Nail said beside me.
"Yeah?"
"Yes," I said. "If you want to step off, I'll understand. Do it now before it's too late."
"You staying?"
Kiss asked Nail.
"Of course,"
he replied.
"I'm staying too,"
she told me, fixing me with those terrible green eyes.
"It's an honor thing."
"Because you want revenge?" I asked.
"No, because I'm sworn to you, and this is what we do."
We left Kiss to finish her song. Carl Thonius was harder to locate. The boundaries of his dream were thick and clotted, and when we entered them, we found ourselves lost in a forest of clothing racks hung with thousands of beautiful garments. The air was colder than Nail's alpine dream. "Carl? Carl!" At the heart of the forest of hanging clothes, Carl Thonius sat naked in a clearing, surrounded by framed mirrors. He rose as we dragged our way in through the jackets and pantaloons and waistcoats. He put on a robe. The innermost rings around the clearing were bare metal racks, rattling with empty clothes hangers.
"This is an intrusion," he said.
Carl Thonius was a very mannered person, slender and spare, elegant, his hair a blonde, coiffured fringe. His voice trailed away as he saw the guys I'd come in.
"He wants to ask you the question,"
Nail said, grinning at Thonius's discomfort.
"You know, the question."
"The Inquisitor knows the answer,"
Carl replied tersely.
"I am his interrogator. I go where he goes, in the Emperor's name, worlds without end."
"Thank you. But I had to ask, Carl," I said.
"I know you did, sir,"
he answered, pulling his robe tight.
"Our status is special condition."
"Yes. When we arrive at Eustace Majoris," I said, "our first problem will be establishing and maintaining cover identity. False documents won't get us very far, and I'll be damned if we're going to lose our only advantage."
"We'll all be damned,"
smiled Carl. "Then we need something else, something clever."
"I'll give it a little thought, sir," he said.
Two pale wan suns were setting over us as we crunched down a stretch of foreshore together. There was a figure ahead of us in the twilight, scooping and searching along the beach. The shoreline was littered with billions of left hands, each one real in flesh and blood. All the same, each one was impossibly fitted with a chrome bracket at the wrist. Zeph Mathewin was moving along the shoreline, picking up each hand in turn and trying it against the socket of his left arm. Each misfitting hand he tossed aside. Mathewin was a tall, dark-skinned man of enormous physical strength. His black hair was braided in rows. In this, his dream, his eyes weren't the red coal augmetic flicker of life. They were soft and brown. He looked round as we approached, discarding another clenching hand.
"Shit,"
said Nail, gazing at the long, wide beach of twitching hands.
"Zeph's dreams are so much freakier than mine."
"Zeph," I called out.
"I can't find it. Can't find it. Can't."
"Zeph," I said again.
"What?"
he barked, turning to glare at me.
"I wanted to ask." "The answer's yes," he said, and turned back to his sorting along the shoreline of wriggling fingers.
We finally located Cara Swole in a dressing room behind a thunderous wooden carnival hall in the backwoods of Bonaventure. Outside, barkers with brass voice trumpets shouted the odds, and the crowd was roaring. Kara sat before the harshly lit makeup mirror, her red hair pulled back in a lace strap as she white-powdered her face. Short, supple, voluptuous, she turned in her camp chair as we came in.
"Is it time already?" she asked.
"Yes," I said.
"Time to go on?"
"Yes." She came over to me and stroked my arms, tugging at my cuffs.
"You are such a handsome man, Gideon."
"Thank you."
"Sometimes I forget. I forget what you looked like back then. You haven't come to me this way in a long time."
"That's just what I said," said Nail.
Kara's face changed.
"I'm dreaming, aren't I?"
"Yes, you are."
"We're starting tomorrow, aren't we?"
"Yes."
"This is the dream where you come and ask me if I want to go on, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is."
"Even to the death?"
"Even that."
"What about the others?"
"Patience, Zeph, and Carl are all with me," I said.
"Me too,"
said Nail.
"Frauke and Zale?"
"I couldn't get into Frauke's dreams if I tried, and I won't get into the boys. It's just us, the band. I needed to know if you were still with me."
"Of course."
"Kara, now's the time. The last time. If you want out, say now."
"Are you kidding?" she said. "The show must go on."
The following morning, ship time, the Arethusa translated back into material space on the edge of the Eustis system. The old freighter had been so often repaired and rebuilt during its lifetime that all clues to its original class and designation had long since vanished in the patchwork mess of its hull. Unworth liked to think of it, and by extension himself too, as a rogue trader, but it was little more than a tinker ship, scraping a living in cheap trinkets and surplus perishables up and down the trade lanes. From retranslation, we joined the busy in-system route, and finally picked up the services of a pilot boat, which led us in through the overcrowded rafts of the high anchor harbours to a vacant dock. Berthing fees were 20 crowns a day, and we reserved the anchorage for a calendar month. The stained globe of Eustis Majoris revolved slowly beneath us. The orbital harbours were superstructures of brass and steel, resembling in their structure and their glittering lights giant circus calliopes the size of continents, linked together in a loose string. More than 10,000 vessels alone clung at anchor to the scaffold wharfs around us. Some of the ships were private merchantmen, hauliers, trade runners, others vast mass conveyance vessels from the noble chartered companies and the franchised lines. Rows of dull grey Munitorum freighters suckled against raft edges. Gold and crimson mission ships of the ecclesiarchy, splendid as ceremonial scepters, dragged at the titanic chains that moored them to private, consecrated docking areas. In the distance, threat black warships skulked in armoured pens separate from the main harbours. Near space bustled with traffic. Shuttles, service ships, mobile derricks, tankers, lighters, lift ships bound for the surface, taking the traders' merchandise down to the markets of Eustis Majoris's cities. Apart from cursory identification, pilot ship dues, and berthing registration, no one really noticed the Arethusa. Just another mangy, nondescript tramp, limping in with ice on its pitted hull, trailing skeins of fuel vapour from where the pressures of the Imperium had flexed and deformed its fabric. Carl had come to me early and described the plan that had evolved in his mind. I valued Carl most for his technical brilliance, but this scheme impressed me as much for its daring and audacity. As an operative, he was maturing. "There are risks," I said.
"Of course. But as you said, we need to be able to operate freely without fear of detection."
"Even the best forged documents will show up as false if subjected to thorough informium inspection. And we have every reason to believe that the people we're dealing with will have access to such resources." "So the perfect solution is to get the Informium itself to forge documents for us." He smiled. It was the smile he used when he was insufferably pleased with himself.
"In a manner of speaking."
"You've planned this operation thoroughly?"
"In all particulars. Timings, distances, codes, all the minutiae. Sir, I'd like to run the operation personally. I would regard it as an honor if you'd allow that."
I see. Why, Carl? He fiddled nervously with a garnet ring on his right pinky.
3 reasons. First, it's my idea. Second, how can I put this delicately? Physically, you are our weakest link. The rest of us can disguise our appearances, but you do rather stand out. And your form is known to our enemies.
It was something I'd been thinking about since we'd begun our journey back to Eustace Majoris. Because of the secrecy, I was going to have to rely entirely on my agents during this mission. I could not allow myself to be seen. It was a frustrating prospect. We were here, undertaking an extremely hazardous endeavor, and all because I had insisted it should be so. Yet I was going to have to sit back and watch as they took all the real risks for me. Very well, I told him. I'm going to have to get used to being the least visible player in this game. You can run this.
Thank you, sir.
I will be watching and helping if I can.
Of course. But there will be no need.
He got up to leave my cabin. What was the third reason, Carl? I asked. He turned and faced my support chair squarely, as if he were looking me in the eyes.
Last year I fouled up. On Flint. And later, when the ship was taken. I was the weak link then. I wanted opportunity to redeem myself.
We assembled in the main hold. Nail had a lifter winding up to power. Kara, Kiss, and my blunter, Whiston Frauke, were loading the last of the equipment packs into the lifter's cargo pod. Carl was nearby, talking quietly to the boy Zale. Carl and I had agreed that Zale could play a part in this initial operation, and the boy was clearly excited by the role Carl was explaining to him. I still had some doubts about Zale. He was very young and inexperienced, and displayed the beginnings of a potent psychic gift that he as yet did not understand. That rare quality of a mirror psychic, not active but passively reflective. I kept him with me to watch over that growing talent, to nurture it. But he was growing restless being on the sidelines all the time. Giving him a responsibility would boost his confidence and make him feel part of the group. Mathewin arrived, escorting our prisoner. Fever Sko had been a game agent, a player in the Contract 13 cartel, and one of the men trying to kill us at Bonner's Reach the year before. We'd captured him there, and much of what we knew was based upon things he had given up under interrogation. Both Nail and Thonius believed there was nothing more we could get from him, and considered it a waste of effort keeping him with us. But he was our only resource, and I wasn't about to give that up yet. Incarceration and misery had shrunk him down. He was a shadow of the bruiser who had gunned for us in Lucky Space. His sandy blonde hair had grown paler and thin, and a straggly beard covered his once jutting chin. He shuffled along in his manacles as Zeph led him to the lander. He was pitiful, but, I sensed, not yet broken. He ignored everyone and said nothing, but he turned and fixed me with one brief stare before Zeph led him up the ramp. The squat figure of Sholto Unworth hurried over to me.
Are you all in the readiness, sir? Are you concupiscent for the rigours that may prevail?
Yes, Master Unworth.
And you wish upon me to have myself stay positioned here?
Yes, Master Unworth. The berthing fees are paid in advance. Remain here with your ship. If we have not returned or made contact with you by the time the prepayment runs out, you may leave and continue with your own business, with my thanks.
Well then, I bid you all formaldehyde and gross misadventure. Just the one singularly thing.
Yes.
In all these copious months, you still haven't pertained to me what your business is.
You're right, Master Unworth, I said. I haven't, and I won't. For the good of your health.
Chapter 3
Orfeo Corzean was a rare beast. His papers declared him to be a dealer and purveyor of antiquities, but that merely described the legitimate business he conducted to disguise his real work. It allowed him to travel widely through the sector, and availed him of opportunities to acquire curios and inspect the reserved collections of many museums and archives. His scholarship was highly regarded. He had not a single blemish of criminal activity on his record. But Orfeo Corzean was a professional malcontent, a mercenary, a shaper of destiny,
No warrior he. Kuzian had never lifted a finger against another soul, personally. His speciality was subtle and invidious. He made things happen. He was an architect of fate, one of the foremost expediters employed by the divine frattery. Kuzian did not belong to the frattery itself. He had no interest in being a seer, and bore no wish to sacrifice an eye or blister his skin. But it was he, and a few rare beasts like him, that the frattery turned to when it wished to make its prospects into a reality. Under normal circumstances, he would have been the most dangerous man alive on Eustace Majoris, but that winter he was up against stiff opposition. The frattery had summoned him to Eustace Majoris, financed his passage, and paid for an exclusive suite at the Regency Viceroy in Formal Sea, at the heart of Petropolis. 2 days after his arrival, the Magus Clancula of the Divine Frattery Cell, active in Petropolis, came to visit him. The Magus Clancula was called Cornelius Lezard. He was 310 years old, infirm and raddled with disease, his crippled body supported in an upright exoskeleton. Two brothers of the frattery escorted him. All three wore simple black suits with velvet hats. All three had moved their purple velvet eye patches to cover their everyday augmetic optics, so as to do Kuzian the honour of regarding him with their sacred, real eyes. What those eyes saw when they entered the opulent suite was a portly man in late middle age, dressed in a high-button suit of blue worsted, his thick, dark hair and beard perfectly groomed. He was sitting in a leather armchair, caressing a little semivulpa that played on his lap. As the freighters came in, he put the pet down and got to his feet. The silky fox monkey barked and clambered up to perch on the back of the chair. Kuzian bowed slightly.
"Magus Clancula, a pleasure to meet you again."
Kuzian's voice was as soft and heavy as comb honey.
"We look upon you, Orpheo," Lezard replied.
"Please, repatch yourselves. Let us not stand in ceremony."
The two escorts replaced their velvet patches over their organic eyes, exposing their crude, glowing augmetics. One had to help Lezard, who fumbled at his own patch with palsied hands.
"It has been a few years since we last worked together on a prospect," Lezard said.
His voice had a tremulous, breathless quality. Tubes from his exoskeleton's bio-support pack were sutured into his scrawny neck.
"Indeed, on Promedy. The plague was a thing of exquisite beauty."
"This prospect is many times more wonderful."
"I imagined it would be. The summons was eager. As I understand it, this particular prospect is the Frattery's chief current interest."
"It is. That is why I asked the Frattery Masters to engage your services. Let me introduce my companions, Arthus and Stefoy, both able seers."
"Brothers,"
Kuzian nodded. The men were typical of the frattery, their faces scarred and twisted from the rigours of cult initiation, their hands worn and eroded from working the silver mirrors.
"Will you take refreshment?"
"A little wine, or secum liquor, perhaps,"
Lezard said. Kuzian nodded. Nearby stood his watcher, a tall, muscular woman with short blonde hair and an anvil-hard face. She wore a tight khaki body glove with a fur trim. Her name was Layla Slade.
"Layla."
She retreated obediently to call for service. Lezard limped around the chamber, the pistons of his exoskeleton wheezing. Kuzian had decorated the room with his own ornaments. Lezard examined a few, chuckling from time to time.
"Your collection grows, I see," he said.
"People die all the time,"
Kuzian replied lightly.
"Indeed they do. But tell me, this key..."
"It choked a child on Gudrun."
"Did it? And this paving stone?"
"Once lay at the very top of the processional steps outside the Templum at Arnak. The glass vial beside it contains some of the rainwater that made it wet and treacherous to an unsuspecting pilgrim."
"Forgive me," one of the freighters, Arthus, said. "I don't understand." Kuzian smiled.
"I collect deodants," he said.
Arthus looked bemused.
"A deodant,"
Kuzian said,
"is an object that has directly caused the death of a person or persons. This tile from the roof of an auction house on Dura, which cracked the skull of a passing magistrate. This ink pen whose filthy nib poisoned the blood of the administratum cleric who accidentally speared himself in the buttock. This thunderstone, falling like a missile from the open sky onto a herdsman in Meigel County. This apple, sealed in a plastic block to preserve it. You notice the single bite mark? The poor woman was allergic to the juice.
Extraordinary, said Arthus. May I ask, why?
Why do I collect them? Cherish them? You know what I do, Freighter Arthus. I engineer destiny. These objects fascinate me. I believe they contain a vestige of some outer force, some happenstance. Each one crude and of itself worthless, but empowered. I keep them by me as charms. Every single one has changed a person's fate. They remind me how fickle and sudden fate can be, how easily twisted.
They're the source of your power, Stefoy wondered.
They're just a collection of things,
Kazian said.
All of them yearn to shape the future as completely and as fully as I do.
Layla Slade returned with a tray of hot sekum in drinking kettles. She served the men as they took their seats under the tall windows of the suite. The semi-vulpa scurried playfully under their chairs. Outside, the rain lashed the grim high stacks of the city.
Tell me about the prospect, Kazian said, sipping from his drinking kettle's spout.
How much do you know, Orfeo?
Lezard replied. Kazian shrugged.
The Frattery seers on Nova Derma have seen something in their silver mirrors. A prospect, that is, and I understand this is almost unheard of. Almost 100% likely. Something will occur here, on Eustace Majoris, before the end of the year. A demonic manifestation. It will shake history. Its name will be Slight.
A decent appraisal,
the Magus Clankula replied, as Stefoy helped him suck from his kettle.
Arthus, the rest.
Arthus leaned forward in his seat and put his kettle down. He stank from the sores on his body, but Orfeo Kazian was too well-mannered to register distaste.
The name, Expediter, will indeed be Slight. Perhaps the name may be Sleet or Slate.
Slight will do,
Kazian said, raising a hand.
What I don't understand is this. I was told of an almost 100% certainty. Why in the name of darkness do you need my services?
The key word, sir, is almost, Stefoy said. In the last few months, our brother seers on Nova Derma have reported a clouding.
A clouding?
The prospect is becoming less certain, as if fate is twisting against it. We need to confirm fate's path, make it certain again, and make it true. The prospect was seen to occur between the start of 400 and the end of 403. That time is almost on us now.
I see, said Kalzean. Now, does this prospect have a focus?
Arthus reached into his suit pocket and produced a sheaf of crumpled parchments.
These are the transcripts made by the seers. The focus is named here, you see. A person called Gideon Ravenor.
Ravenor,
Kazian said.
The writer.
He is an imperial inquisitor.
Yes, but he writes too. Various essays, treatises, all rather fey and ponderous to my taste, but well thought of. This Ravenor's the focus.
Him, or one of his close associates,
Lezard nodded.
Curious,
Kalzian said, taking the parchments and studying them.
The Inquisition is already alert to this prospect, Stefoy said. They have attempted to thwart us. One agent in particular, Ravenor's old mentor, the Inquisitor Eisenhorn.
Kalzian looked up.
Eisenhorn? That old bull? Now he I've most certainly heard of. Where is he in this picture?
He attempted to warn Ravenor of the prospect on Malinter last year. We were unable to stop him, though it seems Ravenor himself did not believe the warning. Eisenhorn was later tracked down and slain by our brothers on Fedra.
Glory, you killed Gregor Eisenhorn?
Asked Kalzian.
We believe so. He was confronted on Fedra, at the Mechanicus Temple on Mars Hill. A considerable battle ensued, which ended with the explosive destruction of the entire site. His thread vanished from the seer's vision thereafter. To a degree of certainty, we are sure he is dead.
To a degree of certainty?
He no longer appears in our scrying mirrors,
Lezard said, dryly.
"What about Ravana? Is he here?"
"This is where the clouding troubles us. There is contradiction in the seer's visions. Some say he is dead already. Others say he is here, amongst us, in Petropolis. It is possible he is here under a veil of the utmost secrecy. If so, that might explain the contradiction."
"And what are the determiners I can use?"
Kalzian asked. With Stefoy's help, the Master Clankula produced more crinkled papers.
"These are the determiners we have established. 19 names, persons who, we have predicted, will manifestly influence the outcome of the prospect."
"Some of these people are highly placed,"
Kalzian said, reading.
"Indeed."
"And Ravana himself is on the list."
"Yes. At this time,"
Lazard said,
"we don't know why."
Kalzian looked up at Layla Slade.
"I'll need a psyker, immediately. Non-aligned, black market. Find out if Saul Keener is still operating on Eustace Majoris. He does good work."
"At once," she replied.
"Can you help us?"
Stefoy asked.
"Can you expedite this?"
"I believe so,"
Kalzian said, rising to his feet. The Semivolpa ran up his sleeve and sat on his shoulder. Kalzian was still studying the papers.
"We need to be quick and ruthless. We can't worry about these determiners. They are all fungible elements. We have to clear the field and hone the prospect down to a bare, simple fact."
"You mean we have to kill them?"
Arthus said.
"Probably. It's like surgery. We have to excise the muddle. I think we should start with him."
Kalzian showed Lezard the page.
"The Frattery couldn't begin to attempt a killing like that."
"That's what you pay me for. I've brought devices with me."
"Devices?"
mumbled Stefoy.
"Shining weapons of destiny,"
Kalzian said with a smile.
"I believe we should wake the Incunabula."
"Really? Are you sure, sir?"
Layla Slade asked. Kalzian nodded energetically. He was hitting his stride now, in command, in control.
"The brass thief is very malleable, very adaptive. Yes, I'm sure. We'll wake him up."
"It,"
corrected Layla Slade.
"You don't know him like I do,"
Kalzian grinned. He turned to the freighters.
"We'll begin in a day or so. Where are you based, Master?"
"The occulting lighthouse at the bay end of Formal Q,"
Lazard replied.
"Remote, is it? Discreet?"
"Yes, Orfeo."
"I'll come to you there. We'll wake the Incunabula and begin our work."
"What is this thing you speak of?"
asked Stefoy.
"Just a tool. A deodand."
"Like a roof tile? Or a pen?"
Kalzian shrugged.
"Slightly more proactive than that. There will be a cost involved."
"The Frattery's funds are at your disposal for this, Orfeo,"
Lezard replied. Orfeo Kalzian raised a fist and coughed politely into the core of it. Layla Slade took a step forward.
"Magus Clankula, sir, my employer did not mean a monetary cost. You must arrange for there to be persons present whose lives can be used as payment."
"Sacrifices?"
asked Lezard.
"At least a dozen," said Orfeo Kalzian. "The brass thief gets his name because he steals lives, and when he wakes, he will be so awfully hungry."
Chapter 4.
"Hey, I've an idea. Try opening it,"
Nail suggested.
"Try waiting for me to open it,"
Kara growled back, fumbling with the power driver. It whined pathetically in the gloom, and she coughed as rust flecks billowed down.
"Damn thing's corroded shut. Just use your cutter. This is wasting time."
Nail lit the torch blade of his las cutter. The fizzling glow lent their surroundings an even greater sense of decay and neglect. Kara jumped down from the crusted metal rungs. She made an after-you bow, difficult to do in a bodysuit so laden down with kit. Nail clambered up the ladder and dug the cutter into the rim of the heavy roof hatch. Metal curled away, glowing, melting, dripping onto the floor below in fat, orange droplets. The Vox pipped.
"Are you two quite ready yet?"
Carl said.
This plan relies on perfect coordination. I explained that, didn't I?
Yes, Carl, you did, Kara replied. Little technical difficulty with the roof access.
I blame the acid rain, Nail said, still at work.
So noted,
Carl's voice crackled over the line.
I blame Nail, said Kara. It makes me feel better about myself. Also noted, I applaud the sentiment.
We're through,
Nail called, killing the cutter blade and slipping it back into his hip pouch.
Mask up and brace yourself.
Kara checked her hood seals and pulled the breather mask down over her face. Nail punched the ancient metal hatch and it flopped over, open onto the exterior roof. Immediately, a pressure wave of wind and rain burst down onto them. It was even worse than she'd expected, howling, murderously violent. The acid warning lights inside their headsets lit up. A stormy night in downtown Petropolis. The high, flat roof of the Mansour Hagen manufactory was just a jumble of duct heads and old reheater blocks in the darkness. The roaring crosswind drove the acid rain in slantwise sheets across the mouldering roof and threatened to tear them off their footing. They staggered on, heads low, two strange, bulky shapes in the dark, moving east. Up ahead, through the fuming rain, the lights of the city glowed. One, in particular. The Mansour Hagen manufactory in Formal H had once, proudly, been the subsector's chief producer of buttons and other quality clothing fasteners. 20 years before, it had ceased production and closed down. Maybe there had been a new trend in button recycling. Maybe the citizens of the Angelus subsector had begun to care less if they were decently fastened up. Whatever, the place had died, and the site had been sealed by the guild foreman. The manufactory itself was a massive ooze-like blockhouse, a kilometre long and half a kilometre wide, rising nearly 400 metres above the top of the upper stack levels. It lay across 8 sink blocks, arranged roughly east-west along its longest sides. The western end looked out to Formal F and the sprawl of factory residuals. The eastern end faced the vast donjon of the Informium Depository on the boundary of Formal D. Nail and Kara reached the east end lip of the massive building. They had to cling on to the old support wires to prevent themselves being torn off the roof by the wind.
Decent take-up,
Nail noted, his voice tinny over the vox.
There's a kindness. Check the direction.
Nail fumbled with the instrument strapped to his left wrist.
Blowing due east, 7:08. It's going to be a quick trip.
Kara did some quick mental maths.
Really quick, she replied. No more than 18-19 seconds. We'll have to be really sharp not to overshoot. Shave off another 2 seconds to compensate for the way the wind's going to carry us even when we're uncoupled.
2.
Yes, 2. Trust me. Now, are you set?
Nail played out the carry tube from his belt, and the wind immediately tugged at the limp sack like a flag. He kept one hand clenched to the guard wire and took hold of the inflator pump with the other.
Set.
Kara had done the same with her own kit.
We're set, she voxed to Carl. Then I'll start making my way in. Thonius out.
Ready? Kara asked Nail.
For this, no,
he said.
But let's do it anyway.
They both activated the pressurized helium canisters fixed to their belts. In less than a second, the two limp sacks trailing wildly in the wind at the end of their carry tubes had expanded into taut globes a full meter in diameter. The wind grabbed them at once. Kara and Nail let go of the wires, and the wind shear, wrestling with their globe balloons, yanked them forward with brutal force, off the edge of the manufactory, into the open sky. Carl Thonius hurried across the rain-swept street, past the singing burn alarms, and reached the north portico of the Informium Depository. Under the awning, he paid off his gamper, tipping the boy well. The gamper took the coin with a smile, shook off the huge, acid-resistant folds of his gamp, and went in search of other business. Thonius brushed down his blue merskin jacket, flushed out his lace cuffs, and straightened his cravat. He took a moment to check his reflection in one of the deep windows of the entranceway.
Sublime, he murmured.
Tucking his document case under his arm, Thonius clipped up the wide steps and entered the towering north atrium. It was dreadfully warm inside, almost tropical. Well-armed magistratum guards lingered on the vast marble floorway, and beyond them stood the ornate silver podiums of the public interlocutors. At this late hour, only a few citizens bustled to and fro, most of them lawyers or legal assistants, chasing down last-minute details before the courts opened the following morning.
"May I be of service, sir?" asked a uniformed docent.
"I don't know," Thonius smiled back. "May you?" The docent produced a data wand from under his mantle and flipped it on. A hololithic list of headings and subheadings projected up into the air from the wand's tip.
"Do you require births, deaths, marriages, lineage, augment or cloning records, land rights, settlements, copyright manifests, historical and or analytical claims, tithe records, buskage, tullage, vellement, remelage, gubernatorial records?"
"Do you have frottage?"
"I don't believe so, sir."
"Pity. I'll tell you what. What it is, you see, is that I'm actually a student of high imperial architecture. Modern, intuitive, postmodern, quasi-modern, whatever. I'm on a sabbatical here on this lovely, and I do mean very, very lovely, world of yours, and I was told to look this place up. Lingstrom, they said, for that is my name. Lingstrom, you really must behold the Informium in Petropolis before you die."
"Are you dying?" the docent mumbled, wide-eyed.
"My dear sir, we're all dying, each in our own way. I intend my parting to be extravagantly consumptive and melancholic, yet a touch romantic. How about you? By the look of you, I'd say the best you could hope for is a bad step and a wet stairwell, or maybe a rum shellfish supper. Alone, no doubt."
"Sir?"
Thonius spread his arms wide and looked up at the vast frescoed ceiling of the atrium, 200 meters above their heads. "Just look at it. No, look. Really look." The docent looked up and blinked, as if he had never seen the magnificence before. "Splendid, isn't it?" Thonius said.
I suppose so, sir," the docent replied.
"I'm in the front door," Thonius whispered into his concealed vox mic. "Get our little friend in position, Patience."
"You know what to do?" Patience Kiss asked.
"I think so," Zale replied.
She was shooting him along under the walkway canopy towards the Informium's west entrance. Acid rain beat on the tight covers above them. Zale was fidgeting with his right hand.
"Leave it alone."
"It itches really bad," he complained.
"Wait a minute," Kiss said, stopping suddenly. "Let me check." "Nope, I don't care. Get on, and don't mess this up."
"Stop ragging me. I'll do this."
"You'd better," Kiss warned.
She fixed the boy with her hard green eyes.
"One hair out of place, and I'll debone you faster than you can say, 'Oh, Mr. Ravener, blah, blah, blah.'"
Kiss mock-sobbed, her knuckles up at her eyes, and pulled a stricken face, her lower lip stuck out. Zale laughed. She slapped him round the chops.
"What the hell was that for?"
Zale asked, his eyes reddening with tears.
"Just getting you into character. Come on."
She grabbed him by the wrist and dragged him at a run into the quiet of the west entrance. This was a minor public entrance, just a couple of interlocutor podiums staffed by clerks and a handful of guards. Kiss pulled Zale up to one of the desks and yanked him to attention. From his high silver podium, the clerk peered down. He adjusted his augmetic implants to focus properly.
"What is your business?"
he asked.
"I need this one gene-screened," Kiss said, indicating Zale.
"And you are?"
"Subsist Officer, Formal E Department."
Kiss flashed a leather identity wallet open and shut perfunctorily, just too fast for it actually to be seen. She was wearing a sober, well-tailored grey suit, her hair in a tight coil, and no makeup. Her blunt demeanour and austere look was precisely that of a humourless social welfare agent.
"Found this one sleeping rough. Thieving, too. We need a screen to establish next of kin and get him assigned."
The clerk looked at Zale. The boy's clothes were worn and frayed, and his face was sullen.
"Very well."
The clerk selected some coloured forms from his desk and passed them to her through the grill.
"Fill these out. There's a booth over there. Then bring him back for scanning. The fee will be 2 crowns. "Thank you,"
Kiss replied. She tucked the forms under her arm and led Zale over to the writing booths.
"We're inside, Carl. Just say the word," she whispered.
Below them, the city whipped by, dark and dotted with lights. The hindwind was fierce. Kara feared for a moment that it would lift their globes right up into the stratosphere. The vast illuminated shape of the Informium was coming up, a gigantic rotunda of basalt, its exterior dressed in ashlar and swathed with climbing ivy and tetherweed around its upper levels. It was one of the largest single buildings in the inner formals, and the depository of all civic documents and records for Eustace Majoris.
14 seconds, Kara voxed. 15. 16. Release.
Kara hit her harness lock, let go. Her globe shot up at once and was lost in the high altitudes of the storm. She dropped like a rock. There was no time to look around for Nail. Blackness turned over and under her. The city lights whirled dizzily. Then the upper parapets of the rotunda were rushing up at her. Kara coiled and landed with the winding impact on a fringe of stone roofway, thick with bushy tetherweed and ivy. The plant growth helped cushion her landing. She rolled hard to rob her body of momentum. Sheenbirds, startled by her landing, flocked up into the sky. Battered by the wind and streaming rain, she got to her feet.
Kara,
the vox crackled.
Harlan.
Teensy problem.
Where are you?
Somewhere I'd rather not be.
She scrambled to the edge of the stone roof, struggling through the acid-bleached ivy and stiff weed. She peered down. The sheer drop was giddying. The street was like a necklace of lights a kilometer below. 10 meters beneath her, Nail was hanging over the drop, clinging to the beard of ivy that cascaded down the outer wall.
You stupid Ninka, she said.
Thanks for that. Help?
Kara quickly unwound the monofilament line wrapped around her waist. From below, over the vox, she heard Nail curse. The bushy vines were weak and sickly from years of acid rain, and they were beginning to tear and snap under his weight.
Kara,
Carl voxed,
is everything all right? Are you in position?
We're fine. Everything's fine,
she heard Nail vox back.
We'll call you as soon as we're in place.
Okay, Thonius out.
Why did you tell him that? Kara called down.
I don't want to mess up his friggin' plan, do I? I don't want to let him down. He's trying to prove something to the boss with this operation.
Harlan, you don't even like Carl. You've never liked him. You...
Kara, baby, quit it with the mouth and help me. For throne's sake.
Okay. Don't move. Don't even breathe.
Standing in the booth, Kiss mimed writing with the pen. She'd finished filling out the forms minutes earlier. Now she was just playing for time. She sent a nudge.
Carl, we're waiting.
Keep doing just that. Kara and Nail are not quite in place. Is there a problem, lady?
Kiss stiffened. The telepathic voice wasn't Ravenna. It wasn't any mind voice she knew. It had come from right beside her.
Zael, was that you?
Yeah, it was me.
I didn't know you could cast. Since when could you cast?
I don't know. I just thought out loud, and there you were.
Kiss looked at him. After all these months, she still didn't know what to make of the kid. There was something about Zael that worried her, scared her even. And it took quite a lot to scare Patience Kiss. Wistan Frauke looked up from his data slate. It was yet another of the tediously bad erotic novels he whiled away his time reading, though he never seemed to derive any titillation from them at all. He took the low stick out of his mouth, exhaled, and said,
"What's the matter?"
"What do you mean?" I replied, using my chair's voice transponder. "Something's the matter, I could tell."
"Really? How?"
I asked. "It's the way you always..." His voice trailed off, and he shook his head sadly. "You're a floating box." I don't have the first clue. I was trying to be personable. Remember how you said I should improve my people skills?
I remember, I said.
Here's a tip. Referring to me as a floating box is not all that personable.
Righto, he said.
However, there is a problem, I admitted. Carl's in place, so are Kiss and Zael, but Kara and Nail are experiencing difficulties. So intervene. Help them, Whiston said. Carl's so anxious to run this show and make it work. He wants to prove himself to me. If I intervene, it'll dent his confidence. So... it'll look like I don't trust his abilities.
So?
so I'm supposed to be training him, making an inquisitor out of him. If he screws up this entire operation, right? I thought you told me it was important.
It is important.
Whiston stubbed out his low stick and immediately lit another. Hello? Sometimes I forgot that Frauke was deaf to my mind. It is important. Very important. I'm impressed, Whiston. I didn't think you were even listening at the briefing. You wound me, Inquisitor. I listen. Quite often, actually. I just don't care much. We were holed up together in an empty hab on the 60th floor of a stack 2 kilometers from the Informium. The place was a dank wreck, rain pelting hard against a smeary window. Whiston was sprawled on a sofa that looked as if it had been used as a practice target on an artillery range, and then given to hungry rats. He was my untouchable, my psychic blank, the real outsider of my team. Most of the time there was very little for him to do, and he sat around with his limiter activated, smoking and speed-reading his dreary pornography. I cast my sigh wide, and summoned a picture of Kara on the roof of the Informium, Nail hanging from the slowly tearing vines below her. "You said they were experiencing difficulties," Frauke said.
"Yes."
"What sort of difficulties?"
he asked.
"The falling off a tall building to certain death hundreds of meters below kind," I said.
"Bummer," he remarked casually.
"Anytime you like," Nail murmured.
The vines were really starting to give way now. Kara played out the filament line down to Nail.
"Grab it and hook it up."
He got hold of the end, swaying out as he did so on the bending boughs. Frantically, he cinched the carabiner to his belt. She tightened the line and braced her body against the stonework.
"I'm having a sodding ball, you know," Nail mumbled.
"Try and stay rigid. I'm going to lift you now."
"Rigid, not a problem."
"Here we go."
It took 30 seconds. 30 seconds of effort that almost broke Kara's back. Nail dragged himself up over the lip of the roof.
"Ahem. Are you there yet?"
Thonius voxed.
2 minutes more, Carl. That's a promise,"
Kara replied. Kara got Harlan to his feet, and together they hurried up the slope of the donjon's domed metal roof towards the branching radiator vanes that rose like a metal forest from the summit of the dome. Most of the data storage in the Petropolis Informium was beneath the ground in colossal vaults, or housed in crypts in the building's massive outer walls. The sheer quantity of cogitator activity in the donjon was so great that it generated a staggering amount of bleed heat. Superconductor nets, laced throughout the Informium's superstructure, channeled the heat waste away to prevent the files from corrupting or combusting, and it was vented into the central flues of the building and out through the roof vanes. Harlan and Kara hurried in amongst the acid-gnawed trees of the radiator array. Despite the screaming winds and heavy rain, they were both sweating profusely in their sealed suits, thanks to the exertion. They began power-driving open the inspection plates of the radiator vane, one by one, and packed each thermostat with insulation felt. In short order, 6 of the vanes were packed and resealed.
"Carl, we're in place, and the vanes are lagged," Kara voxed. "You're good to go."
"They tell me the internal vaulting is really worth a look," Thonius said. "They say, Lingstrom, they say, for that is my name. Did I mention that?"
"Yes, sir," replied the docent.
His mind was still a little punchy from the essay the visitor had delivered on ooze-like dressing, and the miracles of ornamentation the Informium's original architect had managed, despite a lifelong battle with scrofula and a testicular asymmetry.
"Well, I should so love to see the internal vaulting."
"The building's about to close to the public," the docent said. "In just a few minutes, in fact."
"That's all I'd need," Thonia said. "Just a peek, you understand."
"Very well," the docent replied.
He led Thonius across the marble floor to the silver podiums of the public interlocutors.
"What is your business?"
asked the nearest.
"A visitor expressing interest in the architecture," the docent explained. "A very knowledgeable man. He'd like to see the internal vaulting. He understands that public access will finish in a short while."
"Very well," said the clerk.
"Thank you, dear sir," said Thonius, bowing.
The silver podium chattered quietly and issued a yellow pass ribbon from a slot in its side. The docent took it and pinned it to Thonius's lapel.
"Visitor's permit," he explained.
public areas only. Carl smiled. The docent wore a pass ribbon of his own, but his was scarlet instead of pale yellow. They passed between the podiums, pausing to let the optic scanners read their permits. Then the docent led Carl through the broad archways onto the wide marble terrace that ringed the ground floor of the inner rotunda. The cavernous vaulted roof rose above them, a kilometre high.
"Oh, now that is quite magical,"
Thonius cried.
"I'd like my diversion now, please,"
he whispered into his vox. Kiss grabbed Zale by the wrist.
"We're on."
She led him back to the interlocutor's podium and handed over the forms, along with the payment. The clerk painstakingly read and stamped each form in turn.
"All in order," he said.
He wound on a brass handle. Part of the silver podium's front slid open to lever out an articulated glass palm reader.
"Place his hand on the plate, mademoiselle."
"Do it," Kiss instructed the boy.
Zale did as he was told. There was a pause. A light on the podium flashed diffidently.
"Now that can't be right,"
the clerk began. Klaxons started to howl on full alert. Screamer alarms started to shrill. There was a hollow series of clangs as security hatches slammed closed around the informium, sealing every exit shut with portcullis cages of electrified bars. The guards looked at each other, raised their weapons, and hurried forward.
"One diversion, as ordered,"
whispered Patience Kiss.
"What in the name of terror is that awful ruckus?"
Thonius cried. The docent turned, unnerved at the screaming alarms. Guards and other staff members were hurrying back to the podiums behind them. The outer doors of the building had auto-caged.
"A security breach," the docent said. "You'll have to come with me, back into the atrium. We'll need to do a head count and permit check."
Thonius grabbed him, fearfully.
"Are we in danger, my friend? I can't abide danger."
The docent gently undid Thonius's grip and ushered him on.
"You're perfectly safe, sir. Just head for the exit over there and join the other visitors assembling in the atrium. The guards will tick you off the list. I can assure you, you're perfectly safe. The guards are very professional, and this kind of thing hardly ever happens."
Thonius blinked at the young man.
"You're not going to leave me, are you?"
he said.
"You'll be perfectly safe, sir," the docent assured him. "Just go to the exit over there and wait. I have to check in at the staff muster point and await instructions."
"But..."
"Really, sir, there's nothing to worry about. That exit there."
"Bless you,"
said Thonius, and began to walk in the direction the docent had pointed. Ahead, a guard was waving visitors out through a barrier gate into the atrium. The docent hurried off in the opposite direction. As soon as the docent was out of sight, Thonius changed course and turned back into the main body of the building. He passed a security point and let the optic scanners read his permit ribbon, a permit that was now scarlet.
"Now let's be nice and calm about this," the lead guard said, though he kept his weapon raised.
Zale was doing a fine job of cowering in terror between Kiss's legs. Kiss was staring at the guards in disbelief.
"What is this?" she stammered. "What the throne is this?"
The guard looked up at the clerk as his comrades closed in on the woman and child.
"What's going on?" the guard asked.
"The readers posted an extreme crime link," the clerk said, as if he didn't believe it himself. "It sealed the building and sent an automatic response to the magistratum headquarters. Units are en route. We have to secure the premises and detain the malefactor."
"The what?"
asked the guard.
"Him?"
He looked at the teenager crouched beside Kiss. The other guards had all aimed their weapons at Zale.
"Him? That's ridiculous."
Up on his podium, the clerk shrugged.
"I just do what the system tells me. He's a malefactor. Wanted on 7 worlds, high profile, max security case."
"You're bullshitting me,"
the guard cried.
"This is outrageous," Kiss cried indignantly. "He's just a subsist child."
"Calm down, ma'am," the guard said. "There has to be some mistake here. You men, shoulder your weapons. You look like idiots."
Reluctantly, the other guards raised their aim and hit the safeties on their firearms.
"This has to be a glitch. Just a glitch,"
the guard was saying.
"What does the system say?"
The clerk peered at his screen.
"Palm scan identified